And so we need to be concerned about this. And I look back on some of the things that I did here in the U.S. before I went to Brazil. And I can give you names of guys. That's exactly what I did with them, responding like crazy. And I said, sorry, you got to come with me to church. Or you got to do this, or you got to do that. And I gave him a second agenda that was not really a part of the essentials of the gospel. Well, let's kind of summarize, and then we'll take a coffee break. First one is, we observe, the observation I want to make, is that the first church went through a crisis that is similar to the one I feel we are facing today. We are going to have to know how to affirm what's there and minister in the context of what is there, while at the same time allowing freedom to go to the people of our generation. Now, that is not going to be easy. There were tensions all through Paul's career because of this particular thing. And like Paul says in 2 Timothy, he says, you know that everyone in the province of Asia has deserted me, including Fergus and Hermogenes. And then in Galatians 5, the passage that we just read, where he says in verses 11 and 12, brothers, if I'm still preaching circumcision, why am I still being persecuted? In that case, the offense of the cross has been abolished. As for these agitators, I wish that they would go the whole way and emasculate themselves. And so he's talking about the conflict, the stress that he lived with. We look back at Paul, and we think that he was right in the center of things. Actually, he was eccentric in the sense that he was not a part of the main party line at that time. And so there were tensions, and we'll look at that later. But I think that we need to be cognizant of that. The second observation I want to make, in summary of what we've been talking about, is that we looked at just two manifestations of the body of Christ here in the first century. There were many more. We don't know what 90% of the apostles did when they left Jerusalem and when they were scattered. And so there needs to be multiple manifestations of the body. And we think that unity, we confuse unity with uniformity. But if we have uniformity at the grassroots, we're going to reach very few people. We've got to think in terms of diversifying on the grassroots so that there will be all kinds for all kinds of people. Unity, we find, comes at the top. And we find that in Galatians chapter 2. We'll talk about that later too. And then I think we need to understand that by nature, the church is a guerrilla band. It is not a fixed fortification. We tend to institutionalize, and we tend to get trapped in our institutionalism, and we lose our mobility, our ability to respond to the new thing. And so, using this passage in Matthew 16, 18, where Christ says, I will give you the keys to the kingdom, which is the gospel, and the gates of hell will not prevail against you, against the gospel. And the understanding there is that if we begin to think about everything has to come into that which is there, we have turned the emphasis, the thrust, around 180 degrees. We need to think in terms of going to, in terms of storming the gates of hell. We must think in terms of movement. The institution is necessary, but the movement is every bit as necessary. We are good at understanding institution. We're good at understanding organization, but we know very, very little about movement. And that's something also that we need to talk about. But these are just some of the summary observations on this basic thing. Now, the one thing I want to get across to you guys in this session is that we really need balance. And the thing I find so admirable here in the book of Acts was the incredible balance. The effort that they took to preserve what was there, and the effort that they took to work together within the different manifestations, but to accomplish the same objectives. And it seems to me one application that we have here is that we do not need to think in terms of dropping what we're doing to go over and do something else, but we need to think in terms of a common objective and a common aim and having a common vision. And even in our diversity, we can work together to accomplish that common aim. And so we're not thinking in terms of, let's create a new box and put everybody in it, and we'll have a new thing. No, what we want to do is expand our vision and understand that no matter where you are coming from, what part of the fabric you are working on, it contributes to the thing that God has called us to do. As long as we're clear on that, then we can go ahead. Well, that's it for the first session. Take a coffee break. Come back here at 10:30. Well, we're going on to someplace here. By the way, some people don't have a copy of those notes. Raise your hand if you don't have a copy. Several people asked for it. There's two back there. I don't know who's in charge of notes. Don, do we have any more? We're out. Okay, more at lunchtime. Good. Okay, well, hey, that helps. I've got this up here now. Well, what we were saying before we broke for coffee was that both of these here were valid, both of them were essential, and the reason for keeping this one intact was that the Jewish believers, with 20 centuries of heritage, could be in the middle of all of that exotic, all those exotic laws and customs and everything else, and not even see them, because they were perfectly at home with those things. They'd grown up with them. And so grace by faith could come into their frame of reference. They could hear the message of grace by faith, and it would be clear as a bell. But then you get somebody out here who hadn't spent his life going to the seven feasts and Pentecost and going through circumcision and stuff, and he get into this, and boy, grace by faith would just drop out of focus immediately. And so I feel that the real issue is, what does it take to keep grace by faith in focus? Now, we're going on to the second section here. I don't want to give the impression that a tradition is bad. The fact is that tradition, you can't live without it. In fact, it's our traditions that give us a sense of identity, a sense of continuity, a sense of national pride. And so our art reflects, it reflects our culture, our music, the way we cook, etiquette, everything reflects our culture. And we belong to the degree to which we understand. An insider, a person who is in the culture, feels that he belongs because he just knows the rules of the game. That's one of the things that you run into when you get into a new culture, is that you don't understand anything. And so you step into a new society, and there is a particular way that you greet people. And for instance, in Brazil, you greet a woman by, if she's married, you kiss her twice, one on one cheek and the other on the other. You greet a man and you hug him. And then when they leave, you walk outside and you stand on the doorstep until their car goes out of sight. And if you don't do that, they are offended. And you don't understand why they have been offended, and you don't understand why they don't respond to you as people, but you have offended them by just not observing some little thing that is a signal. It's a social signal. And so our society is so full of social signals, little things that we do that tell us how we feel about one another. And to be an insider is to live by those social signals. And you abuse them, and you become a marginal in your society. You honor them, and you become an insider. We need Thanksgiving. and Christmas. They're things to look forward to. They're part of our national identity. And it gives a sense of belonging. And like in, you know, your high school, you have school colors. And you can imagine how that got started. You know, you have this little committee of kids, and they say, well, we've got to choose our school colors, new high school. Okay, what do you want to do? Well, somebody wants maroon and gold. And somebody says, oh, I hate maroon and gold. Well, what do you like? Well, I like purple and silver. And so that kind of boils down to it, you know, what's going to be purple and silver, maroon and gold. Let's take a vote. And so the purple and silver wins. So this kid goes over to the trophy and banner shop, you know, and he's going to get some school colors and bunting and flags and stuff, you know. Lo and behold, he comes back with orange and black. And they say, well, what's the deal? You know, where's the maroon and gold? Well, they didn't have any purple. And besides, it was right after Halloween, and they had a sale on purple and orange and black. And so, okay, we'll change the school song. Got to get, you know, orange and black in there. So it's orange and black, orange and black. And pretty soon, you know, everybody's emotional about orange and black, and they're willing to shed their blood for orange and black. I mean, just, you know, but we have to do those things. You know, it's kind of a haphazard process that gets us into those things. But once we're in them, man, we'll die for them. And so society goes. And then the inevitable result of that is ethnocentricity. And so we go to a school, and they've got maroon and gold, maroon and silver, or purple and silver, and we say, oh, yuck, look at their colors. And we forgot that that's the ones we wanted. And so then we go over to England, and we say, look at those people. They're driving the wrong side of the road. And so we become ethnocentric. We think that whatever it is that we've cooked up, no matter how haphazardly we've done it, it is the standard of right and wrong. It's the way you do things. And lo and behold, these British have exported driving on the wrong side of the road to a number of other countries in the world. You know, so they've really kind of degraded driving all around the world. And I remember when I first got to Brazil, got my car, the first time I went driving along, I stopped for a stop sign, like a law-abiding citizen. I heard a screech behind me. I looked back, and here was this guy, just about plowed into me, and he was just livid. I mean, he had one arm out one window, the other arm out the other window, and he was shaking it at me. And I thought, what did I do wrong? And I came to the next stop sign, same thing. And then I discovered that Brazilians don't stop at stop signs. And so I became a one-man driving school in Brazil. And every time I would drive, I would teach every driver around me how to obey the law. The only thing was, I just couldn't handle it. I was getting ulcers. I mean, it was just really a mess. I'd come home, and I'd think, you know, these people did this, won't learn. And I felt so righteous and so indignant until someone took me aside and said, listen, Peterson, in Brazil, the law is not the last word. The law serves in an advisory capacity. You drink to that. And so then he asked me a question. And I mean, it has a compelling logic to it. He says, you come up to a stop sign at 1 o'clock in the morning, and it's red. What do you do? Oh, I stop, righteously. And he said, which has more intelligence, that little yellow box on the corner, on the post, or you? Oh, yeah, I never thought of that. And so there is, and you get into a culture, and you realize that when you first... you look at it and you criticize it, you're really being ethnocentric. But then you get into it and you realize that it all has a compelling logic, it all hangs together. And so the degree to which you join it, you begin to appreciate it and understand it. But what happens then is that we develop these traditions, we become ethnocentric about these traditions, and then they become a part of our theology. And they carry every bit as much weight as the Bible does. And we are as ready to defend some fragment of tradition as we are to defend the Bible. Now, I plan to illustrate that, demonstrate that statement with what I have to say in this next hour. And this is one of those sessions I'm a little bit uptight about. Now, look on your notes. Look on your notes, and you'll see that I have... we're following pretty well, aren't we? Are we? Okay. We've written three words here. Form. Let's see, it's function first. Function. then there's form, and then there's result. Now, the first time I ran into this was in art school, and what I learned was that good design will, which is a form, will reflect the function of the thing that was designed. And so you find something that endures the test of time, design-wise, and you realize that there has been a very close correlation between these two. There's a chair that was designed about 150 years ago that could be in a contemporary furniture store today, and people say, ooh, that's new. And there are certain things that they've been designed with such a close relationship between those two that they're timeless. Now, there's a chemistry that takes place between these two, and I want to describe that. You start out, and you're just trying to solve something. You're trying to make something happen. And so you're trying to exercise a function. You're trying to do some activity. Now, after you do it, you've had to have some kind of a method. You repeat it, and you repeat it again, and you soon have a form. And pretty soon, by really singling out what the essentials of that form really are, you can kind of repeat the form, and you get the result. For example, there's a farmer who, his horse died. And he had to get to town. And he didn't know, what do I do? My horse is dead. I got to get to town. I've got this stuff I got to sell. So he was kind of scratching his head. Well, he had this toy in his shed that he'd been tinkering with. You pour gasoline into it, and you turn the crank, and it makes this terrible roar. I mean, it had no earthly use, but it would make this terrible roar, and it would smell terribly. And it was a gasoline engine. And he thought, well, and you're just kind of tinkering with it. He thought, well, maybe, I got this little wheel here that spins around when it makes this terrible roar. If I could get that power attached to the wheels on my wagon, maybe my wagon would go without a horse. So he spends an afternoon, tinkers around, gets a belt on and so on. And finally, he gets it all put together. He cranks up the engine. It starts to roar. He jumps onto his wagon and goes roaring across the pasture without a horse. And he's flabbergasted. And he thinks, man, I really got something here. Just then, he crashes into a tree. And he'd hard roll as loud as he could, but he crashed into the tree anyway, see? So he thinks, man, I got to do something about this. So he goes back and tinkers with it, and he works out something like brakes, and he works out something that'll steer the thing. And pretty soon he's got it right, and he comes driving into town in his wagon without a horse. And everybody stops, and their eyes fall out of their heads. And lo and behold, he creates a sensation. So he sells whatever he has, and as he drives out of town, he sees everybody gawking. He thinks he's enterprising. He thinks, hey, there might be a market for something like this. So instead of raising squash, he goes back and he starts making wagons that don't have horses. And he begins to sell them. And then he discovers something else. He discovers that the people that drive the wagons without horses feel good when they drive it. They feel superior. And then he finds that the people that stand on the side of the road and watch feel inferior and envious. So he thinks there's a market for that. So he makes the wagon bigger, and he paints it brighter colors. And pretty soon, you have 2 tons of metal carrying around a 160-pound person. Now what you have here is you have a function, which is transportation, becoming a form, which is vehicle, and the result is the guy does get to town. But then the form eclipses the original function because other things enter in. And so you find that the results become multiple, and you have changed the original intention of the object. Now we find that the very same thing happens in the body of Christ, and in institutions, and in all parts of life. For example, in Exodus chapter 18, that's the story of Jethro when he came and visited his son-in-law, Moses. And so he showed up there in the desert, and he says, oh, where's Moses? He says, well, he's right over there in that tent. And so he walks over to the tent, and somebody says, hey, where are you going? And he says, oh, I'm going to see my son-in-law. No, you don't, get in line. He says, what? And here's this line, snaking way back out into the desert. And what's that line for? Well, they're waiting to talk to Moses. What? Well, yeah, he has to settle all the cases. You know, somebody stole a chicken, and the other guy says, no, it's mine. And so he settles all those cases. So get in line. So Jethro waits in line 2 days, finally gets up to Moses, and he's madder than hops. And he says, Moses, you know, what are you doing? You're neglecting my daughter? You're killing yourself? Why don't you have some sense? Well, Moses, what do I do? All these people have all these problems. And so Jethro says, well, there ought to be some men around here that can help you with this. Point 70 men who can take all these cases. You stick with the hard ones, and then you'll have some more time for my daughter. So Moses has a good idea. He did it. And so you have the establishment of the 70 elders. Well, now, a problem, there was a function that needed to be exercised. There, Israel needed to be judged. The form was, so Moses has a good idea. He did it. And so you have the establishment of the 70 elders. Well, now, a problem, there was a function that needed to be exercised. There, Israel needed to be judged. The form was the establishment of 70 elders. And the result was that Moses lived happily ever after. And the people of Israel were judged. Now, we find the trait, the predominant trait of forms, is their ability to survive. People say that if there is a nuclear holocaust, the only thing that will survive will be the cockroaches. I would take exception to that. Forms and cockroaches will survive. I mean, the forms will be there. Look at Ezekiel chapter 8. And here we have those 70 elders. You know, they're still going strong. And God says, now I'm going to show you why I'm going to judge Israel. Now remember, these men were appointed to judge Israel. Now God is still talking about judgment, but the shoe's on the other foot. He says, now I'm going to tell you why I'm going to judge Israel. Take a look. Verse 6, Ezekiel 8. And he said to me, son of man, do you see what they are doing? The utterly detestable things the house of Israel is doing here. Things that will drive me far from my sanctuary. But you haven't seen anything yet. Then he brought me to the entrance to the court. I looked and I saw a hole in the wall. So he said, son of man, dig into the wall. So I dug into the wall and the doorway was there. He said, okay, go through the door. And so I went in and looked, verse 10, and I saw portrayed all over the walls all kinds of crawling things and detestable animals and all the idols of the house of Israel. Probably, you know, something like pornography. And then what was going on? In front of them stood 70 elders of the house of Israel. There they were. The form was intact. And Jazaniah, the son of Shaphan, had Moses' place, was standing among them. Each had a censer in his hand, and a fragrant cloud of incense was rising. And so God says, now, do you see what's going on? Do you see the thought life of the leaders of the nation? That's why I'm going to judge them. And that was why God judged Israel. And so this form that was established to accomplish a particular purpose was used to wound up causing the downfall of the nation of Israel. So then we get over into the New Testament, and you find that, sure enough, there it is. In Matthew chapter 23, it had survived the Babylonian captivity, and this form had survived the Babylonian captivity. They had gone back into Canaan, back into Jerusalem, and they reconstructed this 70 elders. By this time, it's the Sanhedrin. And Jesus says in verse 2, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. So there it is. It's all intact. How are things going in Israel? Great. It's all intact. Everybody's there. All the job slots are filled, and the hierarchy is in order. And then he says, now, obey them because the structure's there. Do what they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. And he describes how, and you know the passage, I won't take the time to explain it, but he describes how that structure militated against accomplishing the purposes of God. Then, to see how far this thing goes, in John chapter 11, we have the story of Lazarus, who was raised from the dead. And that's a rather unusual thing. I haven't had any of my friends be raised from the dead. You know, it would rather be kind of a traffic stopper for someone to do that. And here is, you know, these 70 elders. And they're reacting to Lazarus's being raised from the dead. And what's their reaction? They say in verse 47, what are we accomplishing? Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. Now, what's so bad about that? We want everybody to believe in him. But there's no. Then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. And so man feverishly hangs on to his position. That structure, that form, is going to it will resist the Holocaust. It will be there. And so their solution, you find in the next chapter, was, maybe what we ought to do, I think that's in verse someplace here, verse 11, or verse 10. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. Now the way to protect the structure, to heck with the truth, let's hang on to the structure, so let's kill Lazarus, get him out of the way, and then the whole thing will kind of die down. That was their plan. And we see that what's happening here is that forms tend to lose their original meaning. And they tend to lose their effectiveness. And when they do lose their effectiveness, they take on or lose their periods in history punctuated by 1,000 years of dark ages, and in each of these 300-500 year periods of history, you have this phenomena taking place. Now, the first one is from the Babylonian captivity, or the return from the Babylon of the remnant to Jerusalem, to the coming of Christ. The second one is the first 500 years of church history, and the third one is the Reformation up to today. And what I want to show you is that gradually this process of evolving from a viable, very important function into forms, the inevitable consequence is that the results become distorted. In fact, they turn on the original function and devour it. Let's start with let's see. Well, the year was about 520 B.C. when the remnant was allowed under the Persian Empire emperor to return to Jerusalem. And you know the story of how, first of all, Ezra went, and they began to rebuild the temple. And then after that, Nehemiah went, and they began to build the wall. And here was this remnant, a ragtag bunch, and they had just gone through a severe captivity, and they were smarting from it, and they knew why they'd gone into captivity. In Amos chapter 2, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum. Amos chapter 2, verse 6. It says, "For three sins of Israel, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. They sell the righteous for silver, the needy for a pair of sandals. They trample the heads of the poor as upon the dust of the ground, and deny justice to the oppressed. Father and son use the same girl, and so profane my holy name. They lie down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge. In the house of their God, they drink wine taken as fines." And so he's saying, you're being judged because of your injustice, because of your immorality, because of your idolatry. And then in Nehemiah, in Nehemiah chapter 13, there's a statement as to why they went into captivity. Verse 18, "What is this wicked thing you are doing, desecrating the Sabbath day? Didn't your forefathers do the same things, so that our God brought all this calamity upon us and upon this city? Now you are stirring up more wrath against Israel by desecrating the Sabbath." And so the two areas that they were really frightened about was their injustices and idolatry on the one hand, and then the desecration of the Sabbath on the other, and they knew that that was why they had gone on into captivity. And so they came back from the captivity and said, "We don't want to go through that again." And so in that context, you have Ezra, this passage that we've all memorized. You have Ezra, who has set out, and his decision is, we are not going to let this happen to us again. So in Ezra 7:8, it says, "Ezra arrived in Jerusalem in the fifth month of the seventh year of the king. He had begun his journey from Babylon on the first day of the month, and he arrived in Jerusalem on the first day of the fifth month, for the good hand of his God was on him. For Ezra had devoted himself to the study and observance of the law of the Lord, and to teaching its decrees and laws in Israel." So what Ezra set out to do was, okay, for the sake of national security, and for the sake of our survival, we've got to obey God. And so their concern was hold together as a nation, and the means to it was orthodoxy, or obedience to God. And he had the very same thing in Nehemiah chapter 8, verses 2 through 4. "So on the first day of the seventh month, Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly, which is made up of men and women, and all who were able to understand. He read it aloud from daybreak till noon as he faced the square before the water gate in the presence of the men, women, and others who could understand. And all the people listened attentively to the book of the law." And he goes on and describes how they did it. "Ezra opened the book. All the people could see him because he was standing above them. And as he opened it, the people all stood up. Ezra praised the Lord, the great God, and all the people lifted their hands and responded, 'Amen, amen.' Then they bowed down and worshiped the Lord with their faces to the ground." Now, what Ezra and Nehemiah were doing was exactly what they had to do, namely, to make sure that the people got a hold of the law and obeyed it, because they knew that the judgment of God was upon anybody who didn't do that. So Ezra came and gone, but they became an institution. Because for the next 100 years after that, you had what was called the Sofrim. You have that in your notes. A Sofir is single, singular, and a Sofrim is plural. And their whole idea was, let's make sure that these 613 laws of Moses are really clear, because some of them are really pretty ambiguous. You know, what does it mean to covet? Or how do you keep the Sabbath? And so, what's involved in that? And so their idea was, okay, now we've got these 613 laws, And boy, we broke them once, and we know what happened, and we don't want to get into that again. And so they thought, what we'll do is we'll build a fence around the law. In other words, we will interpret this law in such terms that nobody will be able to miss it. And so if we can just kind of head off people so that they can't get beyond these interpretations, then they will not be able to break through and really violate God's law, and we won't go into captivity again. That was the whole idea. And so a Sofir could disagree with a Sofir, but he could not disagree with the Torah or the law. And so their job was to interpret these 613 laws in such a way that the people could not break through and disobey and go into judgment. Well, then another group of teachers, Sofir means teacher, another group of teachers called the Tanaim, or the Tana is a singular, came along. Now, they could disagree with one another. A Tana could disagree with a Tana, but a Tana could not disagree with the Sofrim or with the Torah. And so you had the work of the Tana, or the Tanaim, and you had the work of the Sofrim, built upon what was initiated by Ezra and Nehemiah. And when Jesus came along, that work, which is still all oral, was called the tradition of the elders. And so wherever you read the tradition of the elders in the Gospels, that's what it's talking about. Now, just on the Sabbath, they had 1,500 explanations on what it meant to disobey the Sabbath. And so they would ask things like, well, is it right to kill a scorpion on the Sabbath? And so they would talk about that, and they decided that, and this is written down now, it's the Mishnah, and they decided that no, you can't kill a scorpion on the Sabbath because it's quite similar to hunting. Then they discussed, well, can you collect eggs on the Sabbath? And this is there too. Can you collect eggs on the Sabbath? And they said, well, it all depends on why you are raising the chickens. So if you're raising the chickens for the eggs, no, you can't collect eggs on the Sabbath because then it would be work. But if you're raising chickens for the meat, fryers, yeah, then you can collect the eggs on the Sabbath because they were just kind of accidental. And so that was the way they began to interpret the laws of Moses and the laws concerning the Sabbath. And so the whole question, when Jesus came on the scene, I mean, they were watching him like hawks to see what he would do with the tradition of the elders. And so In Matthew 15, the showdown starts. Here it says, some Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem and asked, why do you, your disciples break the tradition of the elders? See, they don't wash their hands before they eat. Now Jesus, his reply, with this reply, he repudiated the tradition of the elders, and that put him on a collision course with the scribes and the Pharisees. And actually, it was the tradition of the elders that nailed Jesus to the cross. And he says, why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition? And so you really can't understand a lot of these passages without understanding the conflict, the tension that existed between the attitude that the Pharisees had toward the tradition of the elders and the way Jesus came in there and repudiated the whole thing. And so in the next page here, Matthew 16, they get pushed out of shape because, 5 through 12, when they went across the lake, the disciples forgot to take bread, and Jesus said, be careful, be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And once again, what he's talking about here is the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. What they've done is they've mixed the divine with the human, and the result is that it contaminates the whole thing. And so in Luke, it says in chapter 5, this is verse 29. Then Levi held a great banquet for Jesus at his house, and a large crowd of tax collectors and others were eating with them. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who belonged to their sect complained to his disciples, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? For that was a part of the tradition of the elders. Jesus answered them, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. And so they are always talking to them out of the framework of their tradition, and Jesus is always talking to them out of the framework of the essential truth. And so then they said, John's disciple often fasted and prayed, so the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking. See, that was a part of the tradition of the elders. And then in chapter 6 of Luke, on the Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and his disciples began to pick some heads of grain, rub them in their hands, eat the kernels. Some of the Pharisees asked, why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath? Well, actually, the disciples here were breaking four laws. They were reaping, they were threshing, they were winnowing, and they were storing. And they were picking the grain, they were threshing it, you know, and they were winnowing it, and then they ate it and they were storing. I mean, that's how nitpicking they had become. And so, in Mark chapter 7, he describes the process that brings this whole thing about. And this would be one of the key passages in these thoughts. I don't think this passage is in your notes. Mark chapter 7, verse 7, he says, they worship me in vain. Their teachings are but rules taught by men. And so they come along and say, now one way to keep from breaking this law is to do this. And everybody agrees, yeah, that would be pretty good. And then he says in verse 8, the next step is that you let go of the commandments of God and are holding on to the traditions of men. And so the word of God takes second place to the tradition. And then verse 9, he says, you have a fine way of setting aside the command of God in order to observe your own tradition. And thus, in verse 13, he says, thus you nullify the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And so the result is that this had no more influence at all on the people of Jesus' generation. I think that's a part of the fullness of time. That the lights had gone out because of this process that we're describing right here. They had carried it to the point where there was really nothing left of God's revelation. And finally, as I said, in the passage in John 19:7, where it says, by our law, he is worthy of death. By what law? By the tradition of the elders, or the Mishnah. And so, why did Jesus repudiate the tradition of the elders? Why didn't he accommodate it? Why didn't he make room and say, well, you guys have some good stuff here. You know, why don't you just kind of hang in there with some of it, but, listen to me a little bit. Now, what had happened was that there was no redeeming virtue left in what those men had come up with. The thing had run full cycle. Now, the next period is the period from the apostles up through, let's say, Augustine. And we find in Acts chapter 10, a verse that we already read, Acts 10:28, that the apostles, the original apostles, were not really clean from all of this. See, they had been soaked in the tradition of the elders, and they had to pick their way through this. And it was through struggle and discovery that they had to renew their minds so that they could get down to that which was true and essential. And so, Peter, when he said, you are well aware that it is against our law for a Jew to associate with a Gentile or to visit him, where did he get that? That did not come from Jesus, that did not come from the Old Testament, that came from the tradition of the elders. So the great apostle, struggling with the tradition of the elders. And then as church history evolved, we find that they too were concerned with almost identical things that that Ezra and Nehemiah were concerned with. They were concerned with the purity of doctrine and unity. And they were harassed in the first couple of centuries with the Gnostics, the monasticists, and various other groups, and they were trying to figure out how do we keep the purity of the doctrine. And one of their solutions was just to kind of structure for it. Does that sound familiar? And so Ignatius, who was martyred in the year 115, probably knew the Apostle John, came out with this statement. He said, let the laity be subject to the deacons to the presbyters to the bishop to Christ, even as he is to the Father. And so he created a hierarchy. Each one was local, but each one had a hierarchy. And he said, the way we will keep the truth is to structure for it. And there will be guardians of the truth. Well, then they began to worry about, well, who's going to look over, who's going to take care of the local bishops? And so they came up with the idea, well, we need some metropolitan bishops. And then so they had metropolitan bishops all around. And then they thought, well, now some of these metropolitan bishops are more important than other metropolitan bishops. And especially those metropolitan bishops who headed up churches where the apostles had labored. And so these stood out with special recognition. And so the next step was to recognize a college of bishops where the men from the more important cities were honored. Well, then it gravitated to the three main centers of Christianity, Constantinople, Alexandria, and Rome. And finally, we got to the monarchical episcopate, which is the Pope. Now, that evolved over the first, really, 400 years of Christianity. And by the year 430, when Augustine died, why, it was pretty much set in concrete. And so, for instance, Irenaeus made the statement. He died at the end of the second century. His rationale was, okay, unity, if there's going to be spiritual unity, it is going to express itself physically. And so that justified the creation of this hierarchy and structure. Well, then Cyprian came along, and he said, now, we're going to have to make sure that we can control what goes on in these little fellowships. We've got people reading the Bible in houses and stuff, and man, that can't go on. We don't know what they're teaching. And so they would go into a place where there's some people studying the Bible, and they'd say, who's the leader here? Well, I am. Well, where did you get your, by what bishop, which bishop gave you the authority to do what you're doing? Well, we really don't have permission. Well, then you're illegitimate. And so they were able to control the growth of the gospel, the growth of the movement by those kind of parameters. And so Cyprian said, produce the origin of your churches, display the order of your bishops. And what that did is it corralled the gospel. And then Augustine said, but you begin to have him, God, for your father when you have been born by the church as your mother. In other words, salvation is through the church. And he, with this, installed the concept of the papacy and it ushered in, really, the next 1,000 years of the Dark Ages. And what had happened, in fact, is that the gospel had been taken out of the hands of the man on the street and destroyed. So once again, you see, this concern for creating forms that will express certain functions and accomplish certain things that we set out to do, those forms will come back and they will eat you alive. Okay, the Reformation. Now, guys get the idea that I'm kind of anti-Reformation, but I'm not. I just think we need to... You know, we almost, when we, a lot of guys, when they talk about the Reformation, they put on their stained glass voices and things, and I mean, anything against it, and you're really stepping on thin ice. And I don't know how you guys are going to feel about what I'm going to say, but here goes. I think what happened was the Reformers, when they started out, I've got to find my notes here, when they started out, the great reformers, Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, had tremendous regard for the living tradition of the historic church. And they were concerned about correctives within the church. We won't bother to go into those now, what they were. But they had no urge to unchurch themselves because they saw that structure as being the true church. And they didn't want to get kicked out. You know, to get kicked out, to get excommunicated, and they didn't know whether they're going to heaven or not. And so what they did is they sought to bring about spiritual revival from within. And so the early definitions of church were strictly local in scope. For instance, I have here John Calvin's statement. Whenever we see the Word of God purely preached and heard and the sacraments administered according to Christ's instruction, there, it is not to be doubted, is the church, there the Church of God exists. Well, now, a couple of things about that definition. At the time, I don't think the Reformers were thinking about writing a comprehensive ecclesiology. They were just trying to straighten a few things out. Missions was not a concern. Ignatius Loyola was knocking them dead. Xavier was moving around. The Catholic Church, as it was, they were great in missions at that time. And so that was kind of a blind spot as far as they weren't concerned about that. And they weren't thinking about starting something new. And so they were trying to get down to, okay, what's essential? And so Calvin's statement, this is what the church is. But they could not accept the papal system. And so what they did, and this is Kenneth Scott Lauderette points this out, what they did was they replaced the papal succession with the sacraments. Until then, the papal succession was the point of consolidation for the church. But what the reformers did was they said, we can't accept the papal succession, so it's the sacraments. Well, now you think about that. We're not going to go into that now. But what was the original function of the sacraments? Were they to serve as a point of integration for the body of Christ? No, they weren't. And so they have been called on, ever since the Reformation, to perform a function that they were never intended to perform. Now, it's inevitable when you do that, that you get distortion. And that's one of our problems. And so what happened was the reformers did not develop a comprehensive ecclesiology. The apostolic was not present. The recognition of other manifestations of the body wasn't there. And so you have what a contemporary missiologist called the 200 years of silence. And you all know the story of William Carey. When he wanted to go to India, they tried to shut him up and tell him to sit down because, you know, when God wanted to do it, he would do it his way without his help. Part of it was the Calvinistic doctrine, but the other part of it was just a total absence of concern for mission. Now, we have struggled with that ever since. Now, faith missions have managed to make it, as long as they are foreign. But I feel in America, one of the problems is that we have no mechanism to mobilize the church because of our ecclesiology. Our ecclesiology is all local in scope. And you've heard many people say every ministry has to begin in the local church and end in the local church. Have you ever heard that? You probably said it. But it's almost exactly what Augustine said. Because by definition, in practical definition, what we're really talking about is there's no salvation outside the church. And we're talking institutionally. And so what we mean when we say that is that the church, whatever begins, is going to have to look a certain way. Let me illustrate that. A few years ago, not very long ago, I was asked to speak at a conference for missionaries for a denomination in Brazil, a very large, very evangelical denomination. And the reason they invited me, this is a little bit ironic, the reason they invited me, they said, we're able to get decisions, but the people that we reach, we can't get them into our churches. Would you come and explain how to get them into the churches? So I said, well, I'd be happy to do that. And so we had a week together, and I talked about going to the people in the world, and I talked about instead of transporting them, putting them in a cattle car and taking them over to what you've got over there, just kind of let the church grow up around them, and no problem, you haven't moved them an inch, and they're in church. And so we talked about things like that, and when I got all done, the head of the mission, who was down from the U.S., he says, you know, after listening to you and seeing the freedom that you have to go to the Bible and then go out and try it, go back to the Bible, go back out and try it, and keep doing that until you get it right, he says, my recommendation is that we all resign and join the Navigators. Well, I tell you, I sweat cold right then because, I thought, if that is what I'm communicating, then we have lost a week. I said, no, I'm not saying that. I said, what I'm saying is the next time you do it, give thanks to God for what you have accomplished, see? And the next time you do it, the next time you go to the next city, do what I'm talking about. What's there is there. Leave it. Enhance it. But just when you go to the next city, do what I'm talking about. And one guy said, and bless his heart, I wish I'd had a tape recorder, because here is a very evangelical, very Bible-centered denomination. And this guy says, well, you don't understand. We don't have the freedom to just go to the Bible and do it like you do. And my brothers, we do have a freedom to just go to the Bible and do it. The most radical statement that I think has come out since the Bible was written was Luther's statement that the Bible is the only rule of faith and practice. And that statement becomes more radical every day as we go along, because the process is continuing. As we describe the process from Ezra to Jesus, as we describe the process from the apostles to Augustine, as we describe the process from the reformers to today, the very same thing is happening. We are getting closed in, and our ecclesiology is closing in on us so that we cannot go out and do what has to be done. That we don't have the freedom under our present understanding to go to the unreconciled. I can give you one illustration after another. Just one more. We have one guy in the NAS, not an American, who went into, after the massacres in 1984 in Beirut, he went into those camps. And he said, you could smell, I got this firsthand from him, he said, you could smell the stench of bodies. There was no, you know, they were putrefying, there was no water, there was no medicine, there was no food. People were laying around dying. And he came in and he said, it was the Christians that did this to you. I'm a Christian. Now I'm going to show you the other side of Christianity. And this guy began to spend 6 hours a day, 6 days a week, he's good at this, scavenging water, medicine, food, helping these people. And he put together a little team of about 20 guys, all Muslims. They were Palestinians in this camp. And he put them together, and they helped him scavenge and put together.